Welcome to the Let's Talk About Care podcast. From carehome.co.uk and homecare.co.uk, the leading reviews websites for care homes and home care.
Hi there, it's Jill Rennie here, and welcome to episode 19 of the Let's Talk About Care podcast. In this episode, I talked to Jess Crawford, whose mum was diagnosed with frontotemporal dementia, or FTD for short, which is a less common type of dementia and can carry a gene, which has a 50-50 chance of passing this on to your children. Now at the age of 29, Jess has recently been given the news that she herself has inherited the gene, which means in the future, Jess will have FTD. Jess talks to me about why she chose to have the test, her hopes and fears for the future, how she has planned for any future care, including knowing which care home she wants to move into, and explains why she now wants to reach out to other people who are in a similar situation and has recently written a series of powerful yet poignantly written blogs.
The Let's Talk About Care podcast.
Oh, thanks ever so much, Jess, for joining us on our Let's Talk About Care podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're more than welcome. So your mum was the life and soul of the party. What was life like before a diagnosis, and what were the signs that rang alarm bells with you that things were not right?
Yeah, so a little bit about my mum then before the diagnosis. Like I said, she was the life and soul of the party. She was so bubbly. She absolutely loved being around friends and family. You know, every Saturday you'd see her out around the town. She'd have a few drinks. You know, she was just a fun person, you know, fun to be around. She would talk to anyone. She was really sociable. And then sort of the signs that originally led us to believe that something was wrong. We wasn't sure what at the time. And I think a lot of us, first of all, assumed it could have been depression because she really secluded herself. She just stopped wanting to go out. She didn't want to, you know, really speak to anyone. She ended up just watching copious amounts of TV, and she just didn't want to go anywhere. So naturally we thought, well, this isn't like the fun and bubbly, you know, mum that we used to know, so something's wrong. I suppose if you go back even further than that, she was obsessed with games and like Candy Crush, you know, like just being on a phone all day every day.
Yeah.
Now, at the time, I just thought, you know, oh, she really loves Candy Crush like so many other people do. But I did realise, you know, now in hindsight, looking back, that is a symptom. You know, she got addicted to something. She sort of secluded herself from the rest of the world to play Candy Crush and to watch TV and things. So at the time, we knew something was wrong. But naturally, just because of the symptoms that we did see, we originally thought it could have been depression. So we didn't know what was wrong, but we definitely knew there was something going on for sure.
Yeah, because at one point in one of your earlier blogs, there's that you go away with the girls, don't you? On a
yes.
holiday, yeah. And there's a video footage of you two in the pool, isn't there? It's just lovely. And that's the type of person that she was. She could mix in with everybody and anyone, couldn't she?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, when writing my blogs, I found that sometimes I contradict myself, and it's really, really hard to explain my mum's symptoms without coming across a little bit contradictory. But that is FTD, so I've said to you that obviously she secluded herself, she didn't want to go anywhere, but there was an exception, and that exception was me. You know, she didn't want to do anything unless it was, Jess, shall we go for lunch? Or, you know, Jess, shall we go on holiday? You know, so she did still want to see me, which was really difficult for me to explain to people, because it's like, well, a minute ago you were saying that she didn't want to do anything, but I really was the exception. You know, and it's really hard to explain that. But yeah, it was my hen do. My mum was, I think, 63 at the time, and we took her to Ibiza.
Oh, yeah, that must have been good fun.
Yeah, it was great fun. But again, I think symptoms had started getting a little bit worse then. Mm-hmm. We did have a feeling that it was dementia. This was pre-diagnosis. We knew it was likely going to be dementia. And, you know, she had a couple of accidents whilst we were on holiday. We found her repeating herself more often. You know, we found her forgetting more things. So I think that holiday, whilst it was great fun and we did make some brilliant memories, it was also probably quite key. and quite a pivotal moment in us realising that actually, you know, this needs addressing properly. It was quite a memorable holiday for a number of reasons, really.
You realise that something is definitely, you know, wrong, but she won't go to the doctors, will she?
That's exactly it. There was already alarm bells ringing, you know, the isolation, secluding ourselves, the accidents, forgetting things, repeating ourselves. So we already knew that something was wrong. But then it started really impacting her day-to-day life. You know, she went to work maybe for a 4 or 5 hour shift, and she would walk to work for 10 minutes and then leave thinking that a shift was over. And that happened on numerous occasions. And, you know, eventually that led to her losing a job, because naturally she would turn up to work and just leave 10 minutes after, just mid-shift.
What does she work as?
So she worked in, you know, at the Deep, it's the Submarine in Hull. So she worked just in the cafe there. It was only a 10-minute walk away from her house. It was really convenient. You know, she was older, so she just worked as a cafe worker. And at the time, she loved it. You know, she made loads of friends and she really enjoyed her work. But then obviously things started getting confusing for her. So she did end up losing her job. And also, I think at a similar time, she was driving her car. So she still had a license at this point, and she actually knocked someone off the bike. So this was because obviously her reactions were a lot slower. She was easily confused. So really her getting in a car was just not safe. Mm. But she refused to go to the doctors, and no matter what we told her, I mean, there's a really vivid memory I've got of trying to broach the subject with her. But she's always said, because her dad died of dementia, and she's always said to me, if ever I have dementia, I don't want to know. So I felt really selfish sort of making her go to the doctors and try and get answers when I knew that she didn't want answers. So I was a bit torn, because part of me thought, well, she needs to know, because obviously times have moved on, you know, medications progress, perhaps there's some treatment, you know, that wasn't available when her dad was around. But also my mum was adamant she didn't want to know. And I remember I thought, well, I'm going to have to go down a different route and explain why I wanted to go to the doctors, because if she knows it's to potentially discuss a dementia diagnosis, I know for a fact she won't want to attend. Mm. So I did originally go down the depression route, and I was told that, well, you know, my mum once got diagnosed with depression and they put her on Valium. And when you take Valium, you can't eat cheese. And I really like cheese, so I'm not going to go to the doctors. Mm. So I got hit with some really silly responses, you know, and she was just avoiding the doctors at all costs. I tried everything. She had a dodgy knee, so I was like, brilliant, let's go to the doctors. 10 minutes beforehand she would cancel the appointment. It was absolutely torturous. And in the end I tried a different tactic, and she messaged me one day to say, I forgot to go to work again today, Jess, ha ha. So, and I was just angry and frustrated, and I was impatient at this point. So I responded saying, this is ridiculous. I don't understand what's funny. You know, with her saying her hair in the text, I said, I just don't find it funny. You need to go to the doctors. You're forgetting too much. And I didn't really have a filter on at that point. You know, I just said exactly what I thought. Mm. And to my surprise, she texted me back saying, okay, I've booked an appointment for 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. Will you come with me? So, you know, all this time I was trying to think of a little workaround. I was trying to fluff it up and make it, you know, not quite as intimidating, or, you know, nothing about dementia or her forgetting things. And then as soon as I took that filter off, got a doctor's appointment straight away. And that was obviously the beginning of getting the answers we needed, really. So,
yeah. And how long ago was that, Jess, when she got diagnosed?
Yeah, she got diagnosed in February of 2019. Uh-huh. The first doctor's appointment that we went to was the beginning of August 2018. So it's took us from August until February in order to get a diagnosis, which, you know, for frontotemporal dementia, FTD, which is obviously what my mum's got, it is a rare form of dementia. Mm-hmm. And it is often misdiagnosed. It's difficult to diagnose. You know, consultants and neurologists are still trying to figure this thing out. So actually, we were quite lucky to get a diagnosis in that time, because it's a lot shorter than other people have received a diagnosis. But I don't think I'm truly lucky, because it took a lot of fighting to get to that point. You know, it was such a stressful experience. We were passed from pillar to post, backwards and forwards. You know, we were told misinformation all of the time. Mum got lost in the system at some point. And it was actually a really stressful journey that I went on. But I stayed resilient and I fought it. And, you know, eventually we did get the diagnosis we need. And thankfully it was in quite a short time period. But just because it was quick doesn't mean it was easy for us at all.
When did you go into the care home, and what was that decision? What made you choose that route?
So by the time my mum did have a diagnosis, so my mum's deterioration was incredibly quick, really, really quick. So, you know, we've gone from her texting me saying, okay, let's book a doctor's appointment. And then in the February, when we did get diagnosed, she didn't understand what she was told. So it was a case of, you know, he sat us down, it was the family, my mum, her husband, and all three of her children. And he said, you know, this is dementia, it's frontotemporal dementia. He explained it all in detail to us. And as she was leaving, she said, oh, I hope I don't have dementia. So it was clear that she wasn't processing the news, you know, and she didn't quite know what was going on around her. And even since then, just progression, it was so quick. And the biggest and most challenging symptom that I've come across is she's totally lost the capacity to speak now. So, you know, it was gradually getting more difficult for her, you know, so rather than sentences, it would tend to be just yes, no answers. And then yes, no resulted in nodding or, you know, shaking her head or hand gestures. And now there is just absolutely nothing, you know, no form of communication in any way, shape or form. She's at a position now, and this happened around last April, I would say, just when lockdown started is when I'd thought, oh, this is bad. You know, she needs proper round-the-clock care.
Mm-hmm.
So she, you know, she couldn't wash herself. She couldn't go to the toilet. She couldn't really eat. She couldn't cook food. She can't communicate. So she obviously had got to the very later advanced stages, and her care requirements were huge. So last April, just at the start of the national lockdown, lockdown one, I decided to actually move back to my mum's house during the day because I was working from home anyway. So I started caring for her full time last April, but it was so demanding and so challenging. You know, we did also have carers come in, so she qualified for home care. So we had carers three times a day. We had me round the clock caring until her husband got home. But I was trying to work full time, obviously care full time. I was in the middle of a university degree. So things for me were hectic, and it was so difficult and so hard. And for a long time, I'd been pushing to say, I don't think this is right. I feel like she would have a better quality of life, actually, in a care home. But time went by, and it was difficult for the family. My mum's husband in particular found it hard. And, you know, the thought of putting someone in care, especially during COVID, you know, it's difficult, isn't it? So it wasn't an easy decision to come to. And then in February, we decided, let's just have 2 weeks respite, just because my final dissertation was due in, and at the time I was about to receive the results to my own genetic testing, which I'm sure we're going to talk about later, so I could have really done with the break. So we agreed for 2 weeks respite, and that 2 weeks respite has turned into a permanent residency, and that's primarily because the care providers that was providing us with our home care, the three carers a day, they asked us, when is your mum due to come back? And we said 2 weeks' time. And they said, well, we can't care for her anymore. Her needs, you know, they exceed our ability to be able to care for her. You know, it's just too great. So obviously we would end up bringing my mum back into an environment where, you know, we didn't really have any home adaptations. You know, we'd not got stair lifts or bath lifts or anything. So it was unsafe, really, for her to come back home, and everybody acknowledged that when the care provider said even they weren't willing to care for her. So for me, I'm relieved. I think it's a good thing, and, you know, I'm comfortable with where she is. I'm happy with where she is. And for me, it's a relief, although I do know it's been difficult for a lot of the family, and obviously it's been difficult for me. Looking at her through a window, you know, and
I know
we've not been able to actually have that physical contact, so it has been hard, but regardless, I still think it's the right decision.
Yeah. Oh, Jess, I was just about to say, what has been the hardest thing watching your mum go through this process, was it the care home bit where you couldn't have any contact with her, or which?
No, which you know, really? Well, if we're talking about the care home journey, then it's definitely been the fact that I've not been able to see her properly.
Yeah.
If we're talking about the journey as a whole, mm-hmm. I would say the most difficult thing for me is the communication, mum not being able to speak to me anymore. I was talking to my husband the other day and I said, I genuinely can't remember the last conversation or the last thing that my mum said to me. Mm. I can't remember, you know, what was we talking about? And, you know, before all of a sudden mum stopped talking, I just can't remember. It's so sad, you know, and as time is going on, I feel like I'm forgetting her voice. I've forgotten what she sounds like, you know, and I have to, even though she's alive, you know, she's here, she can touch me, she can hold my hand, but I don't know what she sounds like anymore. And, you know, I don't know, especially when I was caring for her, you know, I didn't know if what I was doing was right. I didn't know if she was happy. I didn't know if, you know, was I giving her the lunch that she wanted that day, or did she want something different and she just didn't know how to communicate with me? You know, the TV programmes that I put on for her to watch, did she enjoy them? Or, you know, it was difficult. And without that level of communication, that has by far been the hardest thing I think I've ever gone through with it, yeah.
Oh, it is. It's horrible. Mm. So going on to the second part of your mum's diagnosis, and they identified your mum as having the mutation in the C9ORF72 gene, which is hereditary. Mm. And at the time, it was a 50-50 chance that you were going to inherit this gene. How did this make you feel?
One thing is that I did my research beforehand. You know, I was already well aware that in 30% of FTD cases can be caused by a gene mutation, because FTD can be caused through various other reasons as well. It could be through, you know, some people might have had a trauma in their life, which has caused neurological issues. People might have suffered a stroke, which has then presented FTD. So as soon as we did receive a diagnosis, I was straight away thinking, well, I want to know why we've got this diagnosis. You know, is it caused by a single gene mutation? Or is it something else? Because obviously, if it was a single gene mutation, it could then affect me and my siblings. So, you know, again, that was a battle. Everything that, you know, this whole journey has been a battle, you know, getting the answers that we want. It's been so hard to get the answers we need. And we got the results back originally. Mum had a blood test. They tested a panel of genes to see if any of them were mutated. It came back and it was, you know, absolutely great news. There are no mutations detected. So I don't know why. I really don't know why, but I just didn't believe it. I mean, I don't know why. Like, who am I to question these scientists, you know, the people that have done all of this research and studying for many years? And I just didn't believe it. I really went with my gut. So I asked for more information and I identified that they tested many genes, but they hadn't tested C9ORF72. And that is one of the key genes where mutations are detected for FTD. So obviously I went back to the genetics lab and I said, well, you was missing one. So again, that was a whole other journey, actually testing for another range of genes. And eventually it came back and it was, you're correct, you know, there was a mutation C9ORF72. So then I had to commence my own journey and I thought, well, now there's a 50-50 chance, because it's as simple as that. You know, when I was conceived, my mum either passed on the good version of the gene or she passed on the bad version of the gene, because all genes, like, there's two versions and they run parallel to one another. So it was 50-50 of whether or not I had it. So it was a bit of a blur, you know, when you think, well, we're already having to live with this and care for my mum in this situation, and we've already had to fight for a diagnosis and everything's already been difficult. So the fact that it's now come back and actually it is hereditary, it just felt like another kick, you know, when we've already been through so much. So yeah, I started my own journey of being tested, which again was a very long journey, and it's taken around 16 months in total. I had to have...
Seriously, 16 months for 16 you?
16 months, yeah, that's right. And that's because I had to have therapy. You know, the NHS was very adamant that I needed 4 counselling sessions before I received the results, because with FTD, there's no cure, there's no treatment, there's nothing. Mm. So essentially they're giving me this diagnosis, and it doesn't mean, oh, your chances are increased. It means you will be getting FTD. It's just a matter of when. So there's no ifs, buts or maybes. It's, you know, they're giving me this news that you are going to get dementia, and it's just a case of when this might be. Mm. So obviously they need to ensure that all of their patients are fully ready to receive those results, you know. So it was a very lengthy process. And again, there was a couple of problems, a few hiccups, me getting lost in the system, GPs not referring me to the right place. And so, yeah, we just seem to have a couple of hurdles that we always have to overcome, you know, in any of these journeys that we've been on. So, so I got my results in February of this year. And unfortunately, I did test positive. So again, another kick, another blur. But I'm actually really positive about it. And I'm being resilient, and I'm not going to let it ruin my life. So yeah. I'm feeling really good at the minute.
Because in your blog, because like you posted a 12-minute video explaining your thoughts throughout the morning. It was so brave of you and so well put together. What you see in the video as well, that it was a relief to you. Mm. Was it that much of a relief to you?
Yeah, it was actually. I went through a real roller coaster of emotions when I found out. It was quite bizarre, actually. When I found out, I think I must have had 16 months worth of adrenaline just building up inside me, waiting for this day, you know, of actually finding out. And in a way, I feel like the not knowing, or the waiting, was worse than the not knowing, if that makes sense. You know, like being unsure, like once I knew it, well, I thought, well, okay, I've got that clarity that I needed, and, you know, I can plan my life, and it's put my life into perspective and lots of other things. So it was actually a relief. And after the results, you know, I was a bit emotional and I cried, and I even said in my video, I'm not crying for the reasons that people think, you know, I'm not crying because I'm upset that I've got this gene. I was crying because it was the end of the journey and I was relieved, and it was all of the adrenaline that I'd built up over such a long time, and it was all over. And that just made me emotional. And after the filming had stopped, and, you know, I had a cup of tea and I sat myself down for an hour, and once I'd like sort of processed what I'd just been told, I ended up on a bit of a high. My husband was so confused. He was like, you know, you've just been given some really bad news, and I wanted to go out for a drive. I wanted to see my family and my friends. And, you know, I was in a good mood. I wanted to get takeaway that night. And it was all very bizarre, but clearly this is just my way of dealing with it, because then the very next day, I absolutely crashed and burned.
I was going to say, yeah. It was probably the adrenaline.
Yeah, it absolutely was the adrenaline. And the next day, I was incredibly tired. And I just didn't want to move. I was just absolutely exhausted. Mm. And then the day after that, I was incredibly emotional and went through a bit of this is changing my life. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It is the grief. And you, if you can just correct me if I'm wrong, but you are only 29, Jess.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
absolutely.
For someone of 29 years of age to say that you've got that, you know, that hereditary gene, and seeing what your mum has, seeing what your mum's gone through, you know, you've it's just so brave of you to do that.
Yeah, I think in hindsight, I was very pleased that my mum went in for those 2 weeks respite, because I received the results like day one of my mum's respite time in the care home, and. There wouldn't have been anything worse, I don't think, than having to go around, you know, in that emotional and raw state that I was in.
Yeah.
Having to go around and care for my mum. And in the back of my head, all I would be thinking is, well, this is going to be me. Mm. You know, and I think that might have just been a bit too close at that very time for me to be able to comprehend that. So, you know, in hindsight, it was such a good idea making sure that mum had a respite period when she did, because
absolutely,
I don't think I would have been able to cope with that.
No. Absolutely. Are they able to give you a timeline of an age where symptoms will begin being more prominent, Jess, or is that just...
Well, this is something that I've wanted to know for a long time, and it's something that I've really wanted to try and, you know, control a little bit. But the problem with FTD is obviously it it affects people younger ages. And aside from that, there is no age in which you can get it. You know, I've through my blog, I've managed to connect with so many people in a similar situation to me. And some people are in the 20s, some people are in the 30s. You know, it can be as young as that. And I did question this. I'm part of a clinical study called GenFI with the UCL Dementia Research Centre in London. And that was one of my first questions is, you know, is there a way of me finding out when symptoms are going to present themselves? And the answer is no, basically. However, it's likely it will follow a hereditary pattern. And it might already be genetically decided for me that it will probably be around the same time my mum showed symptoms herself. So that would be mid-50s.
Mid-50s,
so,
right.
Yeah. So I've got 25 years of which I'm hoping, I know I will definitely have capacity and I will be able to, you know, enjoy life to its full. So we're just going to make the most of those 25 years.
Fingers crossed, they might find a cure.
Absolutely.
Or a treatment, you know, to slow it down. Because like what you said before, there's nothing that they can do.
Yeah, absolutely nothing at the moment. And that is really my main aim now. You know, from finding out these results and understanding I've got the gene. Because I can experience it now. I know what other people feel like. And I know how it just feels totally hopeless, you know, when there's no cure or no treatment. And you think, well... So I am totally on the fight against this now, and it's my main aim to raise awareness and to do whatever I can to find a treatment and to find a cure. I've got my first clinical research meeting taking place in June. I'm putting myself forward to be a guinea pig. You know, I'm 29 years old, I'm pre-symptomatic, I'm the perfect person to test on. And if it means that testing on me could eventually find treatment, you know, be it slow things down or stop it altogether, then I will absolutely put myself forward for that. So I will do everything I can to fight this, and that's my main aim now going forward.
Good. You also say that in one of your blogs that it is horrible and it is lonely. Do you feel horrible and lonely the majority of the time, or is this why you are taking this fight and this stance?
This is exactly why. I would say I felt horrible and lonely and emotional, and my mental health wasn't in a great place right up until I started blogging, and I felt that all the time. When I started blogging, it was a bit of therapy for me. You know, it was really, it was therapeutic being able to get everything written down and just to get it all off my chest, you know, rather than bottling it all up. So first of all, that gave me a little bit of a mental break, actually just writing things down. And secondly, connecting with other people in a similar situation also really helped me. So I no longer felt lonely and, you know, anxious, and I didn't have panic attacks all of the time. It was just some of the time. And gradually, as things have started easing, so obviously my mum's in her home now, so I don't have care requirements. All I need to do is actually spend time with her as a daughter. My university degree is finished. I'm just waiting for the results. I've got time on my hands, you know, and I do find myself now. I've got my results. That's a big thing. Actually waiting for those results caused me so much anxiety. And like I said, it was worse not knowing and waiting than me actually having a result and it being over. So I feel like things are lifting for me now and things are getting easier. So I do have the time now to dedicate towards the fight against dementia, and that's what I'm going to spend my time doing. And also spend my time supporting those who felt like I did a year ago. That's important to me is, you know, what's the point in me saying how lonely I felt and then not giving people that company or support when they need it. So, so yeah, that's what my time is being spent doing now. It's fighting dementia. It's trying to find this cure, and it's trying to support other people who, and especially young people, that's something that's so important to me.
Yeah.
You know, I was so surprised that at the age, you know, mid-20s, all of a sudden I was responsible for going through this journey, you know, to getting my mum a diagnosis, to liaising with healthcare professionals, to bloody everything. You know, it was so difficult for me. And I was so young. And I know that there are other younger people in this world that are going through exactly the same thing and will feel as lonely as I did at that time. So that's, you know, that was the whole point for me starting this blog.
It's such a cruel thing.
Yeah, it really is.
And can we talk about in one of your blogs after you had your results, you mentioned sort of like about planning to have babies.
Yeah.
How can we talk about that?
Yeah, we can absolutely. Yeah.
And you've mentioned the four options that you've got.
Yeah.
Do you want to explain to our listeners about your journey there as well? Because this is another journey, really, that you're thinking about, isn't it? And it's not like shall we or shan't we. You've got to go through these four options, haven't you?
Yeah, and just before we go through these four options, it's worth noting I haven't made a decision on which option I'm going to take yet.
Yeah,
you know, I've had to make too many decisions recently. I'm just trying to, you know, but so the first option, and that is one thing that I really want to say, if there is anybody listening who is in a similar situation to me, I originally thought, well, if I've got this gene, it means that I shouldn't even try and have babies because there is a 50-50 chance that I could, you know, conceive a child and they would have inherited the mutation. So at first I thought my options were very limited, and it's just not the case. You know, the science around at the moment is so clever. So there is options available. The first option is I just try and have a baby anyway. I just go down the normal route that everybody goes down, and I accept the risk that there is a 50-50 chance that this child will inherit the gene mutation. A lot of people still go down this route because they're hopeful that medication will be available and treatment or cure will be available by the time this child has grown up to be at an age where they'll develop symptoms. And also a lot of people, my brothers included, didn't have the choice to make because they had children before we knew any of this was going on. Mm-hmm. So my two brothers have already actually got children, and you know, those children could now have a 50% chance of inheriting the gene if my brothers have got the gene too. So they've had that choice taken away from them. So there's nothing necessarily wrong with this option. It's a risk that you have to be prepared to take. The next option is to conceive naturally, but have the embryos tested whilst you're pregnant. Now, the problem with this is you've got to wait for the embryos to be developed at a certain stage. So I think it'll be anywhere from 12 weeks plus. And if the embryos test positive, unfortunately, you do have to terminate the pregnancy. So you can't carry on with the pregnancy. And that's because if I decided to have the baby knowing that it had the gene and the gene is tested positive, I've taken away that child's right to actually finding out for themselves. So you're not allowed to test on minors, you're not allowed to test on children. And if I did continue with the pregnancy, it would mean by law I've taken away that child's right. Now, despite me not making a decision, what I do know is that I don't want to go down that route. I think I would find that too traumatic after everything I've already been through. You know, sometimes it's anywhere from 12 weeks. Sometimes you could be 13, 14, 15 weeks pregnant and you've got to actually terminate the pregnancy. And I just feel like that would be too emotional for me to go through. The third option, which I think is a very sensible option and something that I was so impressed when I found out it was available, is something called pre-implantation genetics diagnosis. So that's if you have been diagnosed with a genetic condition, you can go through a route similar to IVF, and obviously they will put my eggs in a petri dish and they will test all of the eggs before they are inseminated back inside you. They will test all the eggs until they've found a negative testing egg. Now, obviously, there are complications with that. So let's say they take 8 of my eggs, all 8 might be positive, you know, so obviously, and is the whole IVF preparation. I think it takes about 18 months to prepare for IVF. So it's still a journey in itself, but it does mean that if they manage to take an egg, if it tests negative and they inseminate it back inside me and then we just obviously grow the baby naturally, it means that I know for sure when we deliver the baby, it's going to be dodgy gene free, which I think is just an incredible way of doing it. And if I was to have children, I would want to go down that route, I think. And the fourth option is just to not have babies at all. And I'm seriously considering that at the moment. I can't make my mind up. You know, if in 25 years' time I'm going to start showing symptoms of this, you know, because I have to base it on what if we don't find treatment. That's the only certainty I've got at the moment, is that there is no treatment, there is no cure, and there's no, you know, definite that we're going to find treatment. So I have to base it on that. You know, if we do get it, then that's a bonus. But, you know, 25 years, let's say I have a baby in the next 5 years, my child will be 20 and they'll be in exactly the same position that I was in, and they'll have to care for me, you know, and I will be the one who doesn't have capacity and who needs washing and bathing and taking to the toilet. And I'm not sure if that's what I want to do. So yeah, I'm a bit like a yo-yo. One day I wake up and I think I absolutely want children, and I'm just going to do it naturally, and I'm going to take the risk because treatment will be available. And then the next day I wake up and I think, don't be so ridiculous, Jess, you know, do it the proper way, go through IVF, albeit it's going to take a long time. There is a waiting list. There's, you know, there's only a couple of places in the UK that actually provide that service. You know, it will be at least 4 years until I'll be able to have a baby. So it's a case of, well, yeah, just do it the right way. And then I wake up the next day and say, nope, change my mind completely. I just don't even think I'm going to put myself through that. I've had enough. I've been on enough journeys in my life. I don't want to make any more decisions. I'm not going to have children at all.
And you'll probably know in, I don't know, next year or two exactly what you want to do, won't you?
Maybe. I hope so, because the indecisiveness is torture. But I've decided, and I said this to my husband, I think the indecisiveness is a clear indication that I don't know what I want to do and I'm not ready to make a decision yet. Yeah. So I'm not going to make a decision yet. You know, I've got time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do have an older husband. So Greg's just turned 43. So if we do wait 5 years, it means that Greg is going to be, you know, 48 years old, bringing in a new baby into the world. So I do, you know, I know technically it doesn't have any bearing on, you know, me carrying a child and things, but I do, just from his point of view, have to think, well, he'll be almost 50 bringing in a baby, you know, bringing a new baby into the world. And he's already got two kids. At the moment, they're 12 and 13, so it's scary for him. And really, we don't want to have to wait that long if we do want to go down this route, but I'm not ready to make a decision yet, so we're going to have to wait. There's no other way around it.
Yeah. Your blog is so, I mean, like I said before, it's just so personal, poignant, emotional, and beautifully written. And I've put a little extra question in here. Would you consider writing a book about your journey, Jess?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
I didn't realise how much I loved writing until I started this blog. I love it. I love it so much. And the response that I've got makes me love it even more. You know, yeah. I think people have appreciated the honesty in my blogs, which was so hard because it made me balk sometimes being so honest. You know, writing some things in there that I thought, oh my gosh, my mum would kill me if she knew I was writing this. And oh, honestly, I used to just about to press publish and I'd have like a little churning feeling in my stomach thinking, oh, this is awful being so honest. But it's honesty that has resonated with people, you know, and people who have been affected by any form of dementia, you know, not just FTD, any form of dementia, people can relate to it. And it's the honesty that people have related to most. And for that, it makes it all worthwhile for sure. But oh yeah, I would, I'd continue writing for the rest of my life if I could.
Oh, and have you made friends through it? And what's the feedback been like, you know? Because you must get, have you, is it just UK based, or have you heard from other people as well?
No, absolutely not UK based. I do have a few followers and readers that I stay in regular contact with that are from the UK, but it is worldwide. I think even from the first blog that I published, I have like a little app on my phone which tells me anytime somebody is on my website. And I was absolutely gobsmacked. It was like, somebody's on your website in America, Canada, Portugal, Spain, Italy, France, you know. And I was like, oh my God, Greg, you know, talking to my husband, I was like, how has it reached this far? I was absolutely speechless, a bit like I am now. Like, I still can't get the words out to explain how gobsmacked I am, knowing how far my blog has actually travelled. And I speak to people all the time. Yeah, I always say it's almost like I've made some pen pals.
But this is the nice thing about your blog. It's not just sort of like you putting your feelings down and then that's it. You actually say, invite people to sort of like say, I'm here for you. You know,
yeah.
You know, I know what you're going through. Contact me if you need me. And I think that's just so open and so lovely. Just a lovely gesture from you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, well, again, it goes down to everything I write it from the version of Jess, so the version of me when I was at my lowest, and, you know, when I did feel really lonely. And if I found a website like this when I was at that time, how would it make me feel? Mm-hmm. And that's exactly why I do what I do, you know, why I say, email me, say hello if you've got a problem or a question. I mean, I don't know everything, but I can just be there for someone to talk to. And I always have in the back of my mind, how would I have felt if I'd have come across this website when I was feeling so lonely and so low? And that's why I have all of those invitations on there. And it's helped a lot of people. So for that, you know, that's exactly what I wanted it to achieve. And I'm so pleased I'm on this journey because, you know, speaking to these people, it doesn't just help them. It also helps me. You know, it's nice to be, it's bittersweet, but it is nice to be able to connect with people in a similar situation.
And going back to what we were saying before, you mustn't feel so lonely now.
Absolutely not. I've got a whole community around me. It's amazing. It's incredible. And it is genuinely the best thing I think I've ever done, is start this blog. And I'm so thankful for it. And I'm thankful for the people that I've met, you know, the community that I've built and the opportunities that it's given me as well. Because if it wasn't for this blog, I mean, recently I was invited to go to this virtual conference. It was a US conference and the Food and Drug Association was sat on a panel. And I was invited to attend and to sort of pitch to the FDA about why treatment must be found for FTD, you know, why we need to get the ball rolling with this. And I wouldn't have had that opportunity if it wasn't for the people that I've met on this journey. I am now part of clinical studies, like I mentioned, GenFi, based in London. I wouldn't have known about that if it wasn't for the community. There are so many opportunities that I've had. You know, the Alzheimer's Society have reached out. I've done many fundraising events, and all of it is because of the blog. So I'm so thankful for it. It's really changed my life in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And finally, you also say anxiety is the devil.
Yeah, I stand by that. Anxiety is the devil. Yeah, this was something that I acknowledged when I was waiting for my results, the lead up to the results to my own genetic testing. I went from being really pragmatic, and I always knew why I wanted to find out. You know, A, I wanted to plan for a family. B, I'm just one of those people that needed to know. So I knew that I wanted to go down this route, and I gave myself some very valid reasons as to why, and I knew exactly why I wanted to do it, and I focused on the positives. But as the results date was creeping up, my anxiety was getting higher. And the day before, oh my gosh, I absolutely lost it. Why am I even doing this? Why am I putting myself through this? You know, it's going to ruin my life. I'm going to die just like mum's dying. I'm not going to be able to have a family. All of the most negative things you can think of ever were creeping in. And the day before I got my results, I was an absolute mess. And it was all down to anxiety. And then the next day, the morning of my results, my anxiety, I'm not sure why, the brain works in funny ways, but I was actually a lot more calm and I was chilled out. And I didn't have anxiety. And I looked back on the day before and I thought, oh my gosh, like, why was I reacting like that? And it was anxiety. And it just changes you. It changes your thought process. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I decided I wanted to blog about that because anxiety is the devil. And when you're suffering with anxiety, everything feels 10 times worse than what it actually is.
Yeah.
I wanted my readers to know that if you are feeling anxious, it's normal, but also this isn't really you. This is anxiety, you.
So,
it's worth speaking about because it's important and everybody deals with it. And you know,
it is so important to talk about your anxiety when you're going through something like this. so important over anything, but yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you started planning for any future care for yourself, Jess? I know you're 29, but...
Yeah, well, yeah, I have actually. In a strange or roundabout way, me and my husband have had long in-depth conversations because although it's likely going to be in my 50s, it could be before, and I'm well aware it could be before, it could be tomorrow. So I have told him my wishes and I've said what I would like. I definitely don't want him to be a carer. I've already picked out the care home that I'd like to be in. We've looked at like long-term care plans, and I work in financial services, so obviously one key thing is getting my finances in order and making sure that I've got insurance policies in place. And so I suppose, yes, I have started planning my care from the money aspect of things and also just from a health and welfare perspective, you know, where what are my wishes, and my husband's well aware of those, and I think we've got a good plan going forward. So yeah, I'm 29, but I know which care home I'm going in, so.
All your blogs are on the FTD and Me blog, if you look up Jess Crawford. And yeah. Thank you so much for coming on our podcast, Jess. It's been an absolute privilege to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And, you know, getting word out there, it means that I could maybe help others. So I appreciate the exposure, and I'm thankful that you've interviewed me. So thank you, Jill.
Oh, no. It's been all my pleasure, Jess. It's been brilliant. Thank you.
The Let's Talk About Care podcast.
It was a real privilege talking to Jess and learning about her fears with what will happen to her in the future. The planning of which route to take if Jess and her husband do decide to have a baby, and the fact that Jess has chosen which care home she wants to be in later life, and how her blog has helped people from around the world and has given Jess this unique opportunity to talk about her experiences. If you want to get in touch with us, please tweet us at carehome_co_UK, or you can follow us on Instagram at letstalkaboutcare_pod. See you next time.
From carehome.co.uk and homecare.co.uk, the leading reviews websites for care homes and home care.